Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Well, Dan, I'm really looking forward to our next guest, Holly Kaplan, award-winning corporate manager and author of the new book, Surviving the Clique, A Girl's Guide to Surviving the Male-Dominated Corporate World. I'm really looking forward to Holly. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Don. How are you? Can you guys hear me okay?
You're not coming in 5x5.
All right. Perfect. Perfect, perfect. Hmm.
Holly, first tell us a little bit about yourself personally, then about a little bit about your book, and then finally where people can get it.
You are so nice to ask. I have been in the corporate world for 25 years. I'm aging myself. But I did that, and I've been in the medical device industry for the majority of that time, and so all I've really known is large corporations. And about 10 or 12 years ago, I earned my way into a management role with a medical device company, and I was the only woman, so I really didn't know what I was getting into. So I had a great team. I had to get great sales reps. They won a lot of awards, as did I, which was great. But something I was not prepared for was working side by side with men. I had no idea what I was getting into. And I had a lot of really, really good experiences. I made a lot of good male friends, but along the way I ran into some issues that I was simply not prepared for, which is what led me to write the book. I started thinking that other women needed to know this, especially as they came up through the ranks and became managers or just higher up in administration as well. They needed to learn about my experiences, and I wanted to be able to give them rules to survive in it. So that's kind of how this all came about.
And your website, or how people
my website, the website is hollykaplan.com. So it links up with my book, and I've got a blog so that women can go in and write about their own experiences, because I want women to be able to share what they've learned throughout their own life and to help other women get through it as well. So people can definitely go there and read up on the book and then also talk about what they've had happen as well.
Well, Holly, you spell your last name differently.
Yes.
Spell out your website.
It's Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, Kaplan.com. That's it. I know I'm weird. There's usually a K with Kaplan, but I got a C somehow. So, yeah, that's it, HollyKaplan.com.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask the first question and then turn it over to Dan. But what are the key points of your guide to surviving the male-dominated corporate world? Because I'd sure like to learn it for myself.
Yeah. The key points really are to learn to speak up, learn to believe in yourself, and to help others, really. Speaking up I talk about a lot because as a woman, I'm trained to comply and be demure and to just kind of go with the flow. I mean, at least I was, you know, growing up. And so when you get into a rather turbulent environment, you know, I didn't really know how to act. I didn't know how to combat what was going on. It took me a long time, Don, to learn how to speak up. Because I was afraid. I was kind of afraid for my job or what they would think of me. So I really had to learn how to do that. And I had to learn that being disruptive was okay. And, you know, I really had to learn to find a support system in that environment. And that's something I talk about in the book as well, to help women get through this stuff. Because it's still a new environment for us. It sounds so archaic, but it's really, really true. The higher you go, the more men there are, and that's probably not unusual from organization to organization. So those are some key things that I wanted to talk about and convey.
Dan, I leave it all up to you.
Okay, Holly, I want to share with you a quick experience of my own personal experience.
I'm not a woman. I am a man. And I work for a very large Wall Street firm. And I actually had developed a line of business and institutional business, and was actually put in charge of an acquisition team to buy a company that was in the business that I was manufacturing for this firm. And I knew more about this business than anybody else in the major firm. And I didn't get the job of being president of the firm. And the division director who was made the decision, this is what he told me, quote, "You don't have enough gray hair."
What? Oh, my goodness. That's kind of funny.
I had more experience than anybody else, but I didn't have enough gray hair. So the prejudice may not necessarily always be against women. Sometimes it's against age. Sometimes it's against color. There's lots of prejudice.
So true.
So give us some idea of what's going on in the asterisk, as I call it, book.
That's a great way to refer to it. It's kind of an edgy title. I understand how you feel, number one, because I had a lot of similar situations like that. What was glaring for me, if you can relate to this at all, is an example of what I would experience would be in an email with my male colleagues, and let's say my manager would say, "Hey, look, there's a great project. I want someone to lead on it," and I would offer to lead, and then I was quickly denied, told no, with all the men copied, or maybe I wasn't responded to at all. And after a while, this can take a toll on a person, not just a woman,
sure,
just on anyone. You know, you start to engage in self-doubt, and it can really do a number on your self-esteem, because you know in your gut that you could do a great job, but yet those mm-hmm. around you are doing whatever it is to keep you back. And you know what? I don't even know if they realized they were doing it. Since I've written the book, some of the men that I worked with have reached out to me and said, "I didn't even realize that was happening, but it was happening." And it's been eye-opening, you know, at the same time, and I hope it'll be good for all of us, you know, to figure this stuff out in the end.
So what you wrote the book. What are you doing now? Along with writing the book, what are you doing now?
I'm still in medical devices. I haven't left the industry. I love the industry. I'm actually with a different company now that has a different culture, that's a really healthy culture. So I'm really glad you asked that. So I'm still in it, and I still love it. You know, I still love what we're doing to help patients with technology and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I am doing writing still, you know. So it's kind of becoming a dual career now.
Yeah, I can relate to that, being an author myself and
yeah,
having multiple careers.
Yeah,
yes. So what were your challenges about in writing the book itself? You said that some people that you worked with, when they saw your book, didn't realize how whatever expletive you want to put in there, they were. But when you were writing the book, were you concerned about how much candor did you actually have?
You know what? That's a great question, because my family questioned that a lot. They're like, "Are you sure you want to write about this?" But at the end of the day, I felt like I had to. And I did a lot of rewriting because I felt like the candor needed to be expressed. It still needed to be honest at the same time. So I kind of went in unfiltered, because I kind of feel like if you're going to experience it and you don't talk about it, what is it worth? You know, and I've gotten a lot of criticism. I have some quote-unquote haters now who are very uncomfortable with what I've spoken about. But I got to learn to be okay with it, because we got to be disruptive to get to a comfortable point, and that's what I keep reminding myself of.
So how has it changed your life?
Oh boy, that's funny. It's changed my life and bringing more awareness to this topic and learning to really speak about it. Not just with me as myself, but to other women, you know, and helping assist them, because now I'm getting questions and how do I handle this or that. So it's helping my growth that way. Mm. And becoming a first-time author is also a great experience. I mean, you're an author. You know what it's like, and it's interesting to go back and look at your work and learn what you liked or what you didn't like and what you would change. So, you know, there are a lot of different, you know, things going on with what's happening now.
talking about the writing process. I've written 7 books and 5 novels and 2 children's
wow.
books. And in the last novel, which just came out just before New Year's,
congratulations.
I actually rewrote the entire book because I found a totally different writing style that I absolutely liked, and to this day don't understand why I didn't do it when the very first novel that I wrote. But it changed my life, it changed my thinking process, and that spilled over. I don't know whether this has happened to you. Has your writing, the discipline that took to write the book and the editing process and all the stuff that you had to do, has this spilled over into your professional work?
It has. That is so funny that you asked that, because I approach things differently in my professional life. It's interesting that you say that, because I've learned how to cookie cutter my process now with professional.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's interesting that you bring that up. Yeah, I didn't expect that, but it's happening that way.
Okay. And do you feel it has changed you as a person?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. It's made me more bold. And you know what? It's forcing me to be more honest. Not that I wasn't before, but when you mm-hmm. put yourself out there, like you were saying about some of the topics of the book, you really have to stick with your gut. As scary as it
right.
may be, and that bleeds over into everything else in your life also.
And how has it affected, as a published author on a very controversial subject matter, how has it affected, even though you went to a new place that was more accommodating, are you perceived differently now that you're a professional writer?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I don't think so. I try not to think about things that way. I just try to see it as fighting the fight and trying to, you know, help change the workplace. Maybe I'm just more self-deprecating than I need to be when it comes to that kind of stuff. I always look at things
okay.
and think I could be doing them better.
Okay.
What about you? Have you felt differently since you've become a published author? And you've done so much. You've done a lot more than I have.
I've written 4 books on nuclear terrorism against the United States.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it's changed me, but I think it's made me – the spillover for me is I write commentary in addition to writing novels. It's made me more aware of the world around me in order to attract information to make my commentary writing and my novels hopefully better. But let's go back to Don.
Well, Holly, we're talking with Holly Kaplan, who's written a book, Surviving the D*K Clique, A Girl's Guide to Surviving the Male-Dominated Corporate World. Now, my first question to Holly is going to be, what do you mean by surviving the quote the S dot K clique?
It was basically that was it. How to survive it, Don? Because some days I just felt like it was surviving because I didn't know how to handle things. I didn't know how to handle challenging conversations in a boardroom full of men yelling at each other. I didn't understand how to handle the bullying because I didn't function that way, right? As a woman, I came in and looked at things as, okay, we're a team. We need to come to a decision together. We need to create a process together. And when I got into that environment, it was not like that, and I really struggled with that. So I really that's where the word survival came from. I had to figure out how I was going to work in that environment.
No, continue. I didn't mean to jump on you.
Oh, no, you're fine. That was the heart of it.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit older than you, and I go back to the time in the 1960s when what I call the woman's assertiveness trend started. And now, 50 years later, we're still coming back to some of the same old points that were raised in the 60s. Do you find that Well, I'm going to ask a question. Do you think that's true? And if so, what do you attribute it to?
Do I still think we're fighting it? Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah, I do. To answer it, yeah, just to clarify, yeah, I feel like we're still fighting it. I think a lot of it has to do with our upbringing. You know, I was taught, nice Jewish girl, you got to marry young, you got to find a nice Jewish doctor, he'll take care of you. You know, I think a lot of it still comes from how we're raised and what our expectations are. So I think we have to change expectations for our daughters and nieces and friends to challenge it and do something different. In addition, I think we also need input from organizations to help change their culture to make it more, you know, friendly to females coming up and into the organization so that they can thrive, you know, help create an environment where they can thrive and perhaps not, I hate to use the words, held back, give them a better space to grow.
Well, can you give me from your book what are two or three things that you consider important that women must do within the corporate environment to succeed?
Definitely. I have three things. Number one, I know I've said it throughout this entire call, is speak up. You have to be vocal. If you feel uncomfortable about something or passionate about something, you have to say something without fear. You can't be afraid to say what's on your mind or contribute best you can. Because if not, you will be completely shut down. And that kind of happened to me because I didn't know how to fight it anymore, so I kind of shut down after a while. I was like, I can't deal with this, but I wish I would have kept talking. Secondly, find an ally in the human resources department who will be on your side from the very beginning. I'm not trying to take sides, but give yourself a good foundation, especially if you're in a male-dominated situation, so that you do have some footing and you do have someone that will listen. And then lastly, find a support system within the organization. There was one other female in my situation that had been promoted to a manager, and she and I were really, we were a good support system for each other. We were able to laugh at things together. We were able to navigate some of these more challenging situations together instead of doing it by yourself. So those are the three takeaways from the book. But number one is to speak up, really, and be true to your own thoughts and your ideas and go with your gut.
Would you? That's very important. Would you mind repeating them, Holly, for our audience?
You bet. Number one is to speak up, right? Don't feel like you have to stand by and be compliant in your thoughts or ideas. For sure, speak up. Secondly is connect with your HR partners, and I think they're becoming more aware, too, of what we need. And then lastly, find the support system within your company. Find another female. If it's not a female, it's even better to find a guy who will, you know, kind of be your ally and stand by your side in navigating, you know, through the tough times.
Now I'm going to throw a difficult question at you, and it's one that we men have to tiptoe around nowadays. But we've heard about harassment, about taking advantage sexually, et cetera. It's the number one headline today, but how do you deal with these issues?
Oh boy, that is tough, isn't it? I got to tell you, I did not expect the Harvey debacle to just make everything unfold the way it has. I am lucky that I have not had any issues with sexual harassment. I have not, and I knock on wood as we speak that did not happen in my corporate experience. So I'm very, very lucky for that. But I think now, since the awareness is so high between men, women, and organizations, that they are building infrastructure now to handle these situations.
Well, by your picture, you're a very attractive woman.
Oh, well, you're nice. Thank you.
I cannot believe that. Anyway, I'm going to leave the question go because, a normal reaction would be. I found out in my years of reporting, well, she must be ugly. So I want to tell our audience that just the contrary, Holly is a very attractive woman, judging by her pictures. So I'm now going to turn it back to Dan.
Okay, I want to follow what we were just talking about in a perhaps a little difficult vein, one of the things that concerned me about what happened in Hollywood and corporate and in corporate America was that, perhaps for a lack of a better description, the culpability of the females involved in the situation. Now, I understand that some of the most famous people in Hollywood, female stars, were aghast at what Harvey was doing. And yet, from what I can read and understand about Harvey and a bunch of other people in Hollywood, the way things happened were very well known and accepted as a, quote, cost of doing business. And I think the same thing happened in the corporate sector, where you had corporate officers, the head of studios for Netflix, and on and on and on, people who left, the head of PBS, and people who left because of accusations of sexual harassment or whatever. And the thing that concerned me, and I use this as an example because I want you to really try and address this issue. I want to use the example of Roy Moore, and not him as the example, but the woman who was one of the four who charged him, and as evidence she presented the high school picture and something that he supposedly wrote. And long after she came out and said that he had attacked her, and she represented this high school photograph as evidence, many weeks after she did that, she came out and said, in fact, that she was not being truthful. And I am concerned about what is going to be the impact in the relationship between men and women in not only the workforce, but in life.
I know.
Because of what's going on.
I know, and that's really interesting you bring that up. That's so relevant. We're not talking about that part enough, right? Like, how are men mm-hmm. responding? What's happening to them now? You know, and then you do have the posers, like that woman who's making this up, which does not help anybody, right? It doesn't
mm-hmm.
help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting you say that. Well, I want to go back to a second. That's a beautiful parallel you had from Hollywood to the corporate world. It's very, very
mm-hmm.
similar. So I think that was a great transition to show that how frequent it is. I was sitting on a plane a couple of weeks ago next to these two gentlemen in their 30s, and we were talking. They're both in the corporate world. We were all talking about what was happening with, you know, sexual harassment and what the culture is like now. And they both said they're afraid to hug women now. Like, you know how someone you've worked with for a long time, maybe you're like, hey, how are you? How's your family? You give a hug. They're like, we feel like we can't even do that anymore. And that makes them uncomfortable because they don't want to be perceived in a way that they are not trying to portray themselves, you know. They kind of feel like they're like, I got to be careful about myself now because I don't want someone to perhaps think that I'm trying to do something I'm really not. So it's definitely changing, you know, how they handle themselves. And it's almost like in fear, which is a little bit sad at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Because the victims in the past who have been women
mm-hmm.
theoretically can wind up as victims again, because men who are currently in positions of power,
mm-hmm.
like you said, these two young men and didn't know what to do. I suspect that there's going to be significant challenges in relationships between men and women, not only in the workforce, but in life in general. And we have raised the bar of awareness, but maybe we've taken the bar too far. You know, when somebody asked the question, why did these women who came after Mr. Moore, why did they wait 40 years to go after him? When you look at the Hollywood people, there wasn't 40 years since the last incident. It might have been 40 days or 40 hours.
Right.
But that's a different that's a situation that it has been a part of. I mean, I've looked at the history of Hollywood. You go back to Fatty Arbuckle, which is way before you and me. But even looking at the history of Hollywood, he was arrested for supposedly raping this particular woman and was later acquitted. But his reputation was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the nature of the charges that causes a great deal of problems in the relationship between men and women. And I'm curious, in your more, I hate to use the word liberal, but more understanding environment, has what's been happening in Hollywood and the corporate world had an impact on where you work?
In my new organization, yes. They are hyper aware of what has transpired, and everybody's extra careful. But the difference, though, in my company now is we've got more women. It's about half and half, men mm-hmm. and women. So it's a little bit different in that respect, too. In a former organization, it was like 80-20, all departments
yeah.
included. And I don't know, you know, if they've done anything differently, but our smaller company has certainly, you know, created its own level of awareness so that we're all trying to protect each other and keep our environment safe now. And I hope that is the trend. You know, I hope that that's what we continue to do to keep
it. So how do you react to the people who say we need more women in leadership positions?
Well, number one, of course, I think it's great. I think we do need more women in leadership positions. I think I'd like to see more women involved trying to get to those positions, and I'd like to see companies that are more accommodating than just, you know, falling back on what they're comfortable with. You know, like the men with the silver hair. You know what you're saying before? Like the manager or the sales director, whoever it was, said that you don't have enough silver hair. You know, just falling back into old ways of doing things. You know, I don't want to see that happen either. I'd rather us move forward.
But I'm curious if we go towards a female-dominated workforce and management, could we find ourselves in a different problem?
I don't think we'll ever end up in a female-dominated workforce management. I'd be very surprised if that actually happened.
Something just came across my computer. It's Love Pendants, which I never heard as a company, now has a new category, Women's Empowerment and Gender Equality category, for their jewelry. And my question to Holly would be, should a woman buy some of this jewelry from the National Organization for Women and then wear it? Or isn't that like waving a red flag?
I've never even heard of this. Did
I'm
you
sorry?
Say jewelry?
Yes.
Yes.
It's called Love Pendants, was the name of the company, adds woman empowerment and gender equality category, and some of these are endorsed by the National Organization for Women. Isn't that like raising a red flag in front of people?
I don't really know. I can't really speak to that yet. I haven't. That's a new one on me. I just had to really understand
too.
The meaning behind that one, you know? Wow, I would have to be, I guess it's like creating an alliance by wearing a pin is what it sounds like.
Or wearing black on the red carpet.
Or wearing black. Yeah, I'm going to have to look that one up, Don. I have not heard of this one yet. That's interesting.
To clarify, just your thought about wearing jewelry like that, that in effect puts something in the male's face.
I'm not sure how that would make somebody else feel.
Okay.
You know, I think there are good natural ways to do this, like we're talking about, but, you know, we certainly don't want to pit women against men. You know, I don't want to make it any harder in this situation. I'd rather see us come together than position each other against each other. That's my concern.
You've been a terrific guest, so Dan gets to ask the last question.
All right. Thank you. But what is that website? What was the name of that one again? Don, I'm curious. I want to pull that one up.
It's Love Pendant is the name of the company. It's a press release. Let me see if I can give you the we're just giving them free publicity, but with lovependants.com. Lovependants.com.
Okay.
And then you get to ask the last question.
What do you think is the outcome of the current heightened level of awareness? Where is it going to go from here?
Well, kind of like what you had said earlier, the bar is so high right now, it's scary, right? I hope we come back to the middle. I hope we can swing that pendulum kind of back to the middle where emotions aren't so so out of control. You know what I mean? I want to see this even out a little bit so we can all progress in a healthy manner. That's really what I want. That's what I'd like
Good.
To see.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, you guys are so nice to have me on today.
You know, Dan, before we go any further, I want our audience to know about your new runaway hit book on Alzheimer's disease and how it affects teenagers. Please tell us about it.
Yeah, Don, thank you. The book is called Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? It's a book written primarily for children ages 9 to 12, but really needs to be read by the entire family. And what I try to do is I try to take the subject matter of dementia and the challenges to a different level in the form of a mystery story with my two little detectives, two little girls, Hudson and Charlotte. And it really creates a breakthrough opportunity for small children and parents and families to begin to understand the problem with dementia. See, Don, the real challenge is that the children are the forgotten people. Mom and dad spend so much time working to try and take care of mom and dad, they don't take the time to explain to the children what's going on in grandma or grandpa's brain. So you can buy it at Amazon.com, or you can order it through your local bookstore or any online bookstore besides Amazon has it available. Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? Illustrations are spectacular. A story by Dan Perkins.
Your runaway bestseller, new book.
Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? By Dan Perkins.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan, our next guest is Hunter Stunze, Senior Vice President of Small Business Lending at LendingTree. He's here to talk about small business lending in 2018. Hunter, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Hunter, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, then about your company and your website. And what are two things that you think are going to happen about small business lending in 2018?
Sure. So, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I am, as you had introduced, Senior Vice President of Small Business Lending at LendingTree, which most people will know from the mortgage world. So, Charlotte, North Carolina-based business. SnapGap, the business that I run, is in Charleston, South Carolina. We're just getting over a little bit of snow down here, which was pretty interesting. But I have been running a business called Snap Capital, for the last 5.5 years that was recently acquired by LendingTree in the month of October. And we have joined up with them to bring more value to small business owners nationwide.
And your website?
Our website is snapcap.com.
What do you think are the one or two main issues for lending to small business this year?
Yeah, so I think 2018 is probably a continuation of some of what we saw in 2017, with the main change being some of the tax reform that should affect and possibly stimulate small business borrowing. We have sort of two things going on. There's a capital investment deduction or full interest deduction that businesses are now going to be able to receive in their first year if they place a piece of equipment into their business. And the hope is that this acts as a domestic stimulus for businesses to do additional hiring, maybe provide higher wages to their employees, purchase a piece of equipment, just generally expand. So we view 2018, because of tax reform, being a promising year. There's also some nuanced changes to the tax code, which by and large affect small business owners, depending upon the type of business that you're running, which should also be stimulative too. And we think all of this is generally a tailwind for business lenders that are providing capital, generally in increments of under $1 million to small businesses, which is a rather large business. Small business is, in this country, a really big business and provides really on the magnitude of tens of millions of jobs to working Americans throughout the country and in many communities. So it's really very important that small businesses are able to operate as unencumbered as possible and have access to capital at reasonable rates.
Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you because this is your area of expertise.
Well, I certainly hope so. I want to ask you, first of all, thank you for joining us on the show. Dan, I'm curious about the model in this sense. LendingTree had been and still is a probably not the greatest way to describe it, but a shopping service where you could go in and fill out an application and they would look to find you three or four, maybe five lenders who would be interested in making a loan to you. And so that you were facilitating, if you would, LendingTree was facilitating the relationship between a possible borrower and a series of lenders. Are you using the same model for this new one?
Yes, I think you've done a good job categorizing how things work on the mortgage side. And our business operates in a similar capacity. However, what we've added in with the SnapCap business model is more of a high-touch service. When you go and you look for a credit card, or you go and you look for a personal loan, or you go and you look for a mortgage, it's generally understood that you're expecting to receive a product that's already reasonably well known to you. If you look up the 30-year interest rate for a mortgage to purchase a home, you generally have an understanding about what your rates might be looking like. You can just simply Google them, and you can see what your rates are. Similarly, if you're looking for a credit card, you tend to know what you're shopping for. Small business loans are a different breed. There's more that goes into the application process. Traditionally, if you were to go to a bank and you were to apply for a loan, there's a great deal of information that you have to furnish to the banker, whether it be tax returns, profit loss statements, balance sheets, accounts receivable. There's a whole variety of things that come into play. And so we find that business owners, when given the opportunity, like to have more of a conversation about their business and evaluate products in more of an open air format. So what I mean by all of that is when somebody comes through and applies at LendingTree, what we're now beginning to do is offer customers the opportunity as opposed to just simply seeing their matches, which is a terrific service in and of itself, and many people do want to have that experience, but to reach out and speak to a true expert that understands all of their options and wants to take the time to understand their business better. What are their needs? For instance, if I'm coming in and I'm applying for a loan, that's quite a blanket ask. Am I looking for an inventory loan? Am I looking very quickly for a loan to make payroll? Am I looking to bridge a working capital gap created by one of my vendors? Am I looking to purchase a new property? They're all very different products, and we found that it's very important, and we can enhance the user experience through getting to know our customers better, and you really can't plug technology in to completely solve that gap, which is why we found that there was a great relationship and alignment between both the SnapCap model, which is more high touch, and the LendingTree model, which is more match based.
So let me follow that with another question. We've had a number of lenders, small business lenders, on our program over the last year, and what we consistently hear is that many of the major banks after the market crash of 2008 and 2009 basically got out of the business of loaning money to small business. And what came in to fill the void were what they call fintech lenders. And I'm wondering if any of the lenders that you work with on your small business lending are fintech lenders or are they traditional banks?
By and large, they are fintech lenders, and to your point, you know, since the recession, we have not seen a return to borrowing levels that we saw prior to sort of the 2008 time frame. Small business creation is at an all-time historic low. Community banks, which prior to the recession had been a large source of capital to small businesses because they were based in the communities and they got to know the business owners, community banking has significantly pulled back and gone away from being the delivery mechanism to these small businesses. And in its place, fintech lenders, which fintech is a pretty broad word, and I think there's some confusion about what actually fintech is. In my understanding, fintech is really where we are using technology to automate certain elements of the underwriting and application process. So when you were walking to a brick-and-mortar bank, let's use Wells Fargo, for example, and you were to walk in and apply for a loan, you would receive a lengthy list of items that you need to apply. So in and of itself, step one, the application process is terribly challenging. Once you've completed your application, if it's complete and there's you know, there's no missing information, it goes through this sort of black box underwriting process that could take several weeks to months. And what these fintech lenders have done is they've come in, they've said, let's strip down the application process to its component parts. And many many lenders have done a terrific job in creating an application that's very seamless and simple. And then let's also create an underwriting process that allows us to underwrite cost effectively without having to involve so many people in the process that it drives the cost of underwriting up and making it prohibitive for banks. And so what we've seen is that banks' response to sort of this inability to serve their small businesses has been manifested in providing business credit cards. We see business credit card offerings are quite vast. We've seen certain non-lenders, such as if you use Amazon or Square, for instance, have gotten into the balance sheet lending business themselves, and they've come about they've come into lending as a result of their merchants not receiving the capital that they need to necessarily transact on their platforms. I mean, who would have thought that Amazon would be in the lending business? So there's been a lot that's come about in the last, 10 years, and I think that we're going to continue to see an acceleration of new lenders coming onto sort of the online arena and providing capital to businesses. And so, well, I'm very encouraged by everything that's taking place, but. If you're the small business owner and you come online and you want to apply, there's hundreds of lenders to choose from, and the message is relatively simple between most lenders. We have the lowest rates, the fastest service, and the most money. And it's very difficult if you're a business owner trying to wade through all the offers and apply to many, many places. And so the one thing that LendingTree has taken continues to do very well is distill the best offers and curate the best offers for the individual applicant as opposed to having them go out and sort of shop and do price comparison, which can take a long time. And we know small business owners typically like to borrow quickly and tend to borrow more reactively. And so having a efficient, smooth process is really what business owners place a premium on.
So are you marketed as what now? You were acquired, you said, in October. So what does a person, a small business, does he go to LendingTree? Where does he go or she go to get a hold of you?
Sure. So business owners are doing two things. They're either applying directly through snapcap.com or they're applying through LendingTree. They're going to have the same great service regardless of where they apply. So right now we are operating independently with two brands, but the service by and large is one and the same. And the future vision is that the business will, we're going to see how things progress, but by and large we'll likely establish a single brand. But for now we're maintaining them separately, but the experience is very similar.
Okay, so I'm... So we have a bunch of people who listen to this show every week, hundreds of thousands that listen to the show. How do they go about finding you? Do they go to LendingTree.com or what?
So the easiest thing for a business owner to do, and the way I would make my decision is, if they want to have the high-touch customer experience where they know they're going to be able to talk to an agent and not simply receive their matches. The best thing to do would be to type into their web browser, snapcap.com, S-N-A-P-C-A-P.com. They'll be able to come to our website. They'll be able to see information about our service, our products. We have a calculator. They can enter the application process and complete the application just within 3 minutes. And the extent of our application is just that they upload some basic information about their business, but we make it very high touch and very simple for them to complete. If they're more interested in seeing multiple matches that they can pursue on their own, really driving the process for themselves, and receiving calls from the lenders, they can go through LendingTree.com. Through SnapCap, we tend to spend a little bit more time with the business owner on the front end, really get to know them, and put offers in front of them individually, where the user will ultimately do less work through SnapCap than they might through a LendingTree.
So if I look at the two, I'm not trying to pit one against the other. I'm just trying to gain information here. What's the likelihood that some of the lenders are going to be the same?
So in many cases, if we think it's appropriate for you, they may very well be the same. That's exactly correct. What we place an emphasis on is providing the lender that's going to give the user the most competitive possible terms relative to what the owner is looking for. So yes, in some cases, the lenders might be similar. What I can tell you is that the LendingTree brand, because it's so vast, has significantly more products and lenders on its network currently today than SnapCap had prior to the acquisition. But now what we're doing is we're basically looking for where we may have had product gaps in the past on the SnapCap side, and we're choosing the lenders that we think are the most appropriate for us to add to our network. SnapCap historically is focused on working with fewer lenders, but focusing on making those relationships really high quality so we can deliver best-in-class service back to our customers, as opposed to working with, like if I go to kayak.com and I search a flight from, Charleston to Boston, I'm going to see 35 different carriers that are looking to provide me service. If you
right.
come through SnapCap, we may have fewer lenders, but we're going to make sure that those lenders are really able to cover our merchants' needs. And by and large, we find that there are, a smaller number of lenders on our network that can provide or can basically satisfy the needs of most of the merchants that apply.
So differential in rates, what you pay for your money between SnapCap and LendingTree, is there any material difference?
Nope, there's absolutely no difference. We're the same.
So if I want better, I shouldn't say this. Well, if I want a different level of service, I'm sorry, I caught myself. If I want a different level of service, then I should go to SnapCap as opposed to LendingTree, where I've got to do more. And given that small businessmen, time is a precious commodity, if I can get similar rates and I can have somebody else work with me as opposed to me doing all the work, it may be a big bone. Now, I want to follow a couple of things because I'm going to respectfully disagree with you, but you got the numbers. I've just got instinct on my side. I think that anecdotally, from what I'm hearing from people around the country as I travel, that there seems to be a rebirth in a willingness to start a small business. The sense that the economy is growing and going to Goldman says that they think that GDP this year could be 4 or more. Trump says 5 or 6. When you start seeing those kind of growth as opposed to the anemic growth that we didn't have for the previous 8 years, I personally believe we're going to see an acceleration of small businesses being formed because there's going to be opportunities because there's going to be more money in a lot of people's pockets as a result of an expanding economy. With that said, and you can certainly disagree with me.
No, and I don't disagree with that. I think historically, looking back over the last decade or so post-recession, small business creation has been low. I think the prospects going forward are very good for all of the reasons that you've just mentioned. I think that we're making a major investment back into the economy through these tax cuts that should be particularly positive for small businesses. The changes in the tax code that I mentioned earlier, the capital investment deduction. I think that's potentially very powerful. And your note about GDP is right on the money. If this is a 3.5% growing economy next year, that's a tremendous domestic stimulus for the country, and it's going to lead to, you know, ideally more people that have capital to either start businesses through investments of their own, or they're able to go out and raise money more easily. I think at the end of the day, the U.S. is heavily reliant on small business owners to drive productivity and to be an employer. We're at or near a level of full employment right now. So I don't know exactly the effects that that has on small business creation, but I think generally if you want to make it as simple as, well, I can give you one data point. The rate of applications for business loans that we are seeing are higher than we've ever seen in 5 years. So there's certainly more people searching for capital than ever before, which I think is a very positive sign. I just want to make sure that the rewards for starting a small business continue to be high, because when you start a business, you do take risk. And it is important that there is an appropriate treatment for the gains on business income that I think need to be well below ordinary income. And it seems like we've taken a step in the right direction recently with this 20% deduction for pass-through. So I hope that this stimulates new business creation just as you do.
Looking at the possibility, and I'm saying possibility because I'm not saying that you're being positive, but the question I'm asking is, what is the size of the market? How big a market are we talking about in terms of small business lending? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at commercial industrial loans made in the United States under $1 million, it's about $200 billion a year. So relative to mortgage markets and other markets, it's quite small. I think, frankly, the addressable market for small business lenders of sort of our ilk that focus on loans under $1 million, but more generally or more specifically under $500,000, is maybe a bit smaller than many lenders had previously thought it was. I would put the figure probably closer to $75 to $100 billion a year. And I'm not exactly sure why the addressable market is smaller than maybe Morgan Stanley or some of the others have put out in white papers. But generally speaking, I think that there is a challenge in reaching sort of a more up-market audience when you're typically providing loans that cap out at $250 or $500,000. So there's a segment of the audience that I think fintech lenders are not yet reaching, and I think maybe that speaks to the limitations of the fast and efficient underwriting. You've recently seen lenders like Amex get more aggressive in providing larger loan amounts to some of their best cardholders, and those are actual loans, which I'm encouraged by, and I'm hoping that that's an indication that we're going to see additional lenders begin to offer loans again to the small business category that's just still very underserved by, I think, traditional banks.
And so what are you looking for business from your two companies this year in that space? Or can you answer that?
Can you be more specific with the question? I'm sorry.
If you're talking about a market that's $100 to $200 billion, where do you fit in the marketplace in terms of loans?
So currently, if we combined our volume over the last 3.5 to 4 years, we're going to cross the $1 billion threshold this year in cumulative loans made, and that's a measure of new originations and recurring borrowing. So in my estimate, you know, we're, you know, if you want to use my $100 million figure, we're 1% of the market. In terms of the scale potential for our business, it's really quite significant. There's a lot of room for us to go out and serve more borrowers.
This has been fascinating because we've had a lot of interest from our listeners, which is basically small business people. And it sounds to me like you have a phenomenal product. We should probably talk off air to see how bring our audience together with you in some way. Are you seeing consolidation like what happened with you, or are new people coming into the business? What are the prospects going on now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's kind of three waves. The first wave, I think, was probably, 2008 through 2014, where you had a lot of excitement around fintech lenders, a lot of money being poured into the space. You saw a few IPOs from certain companies. Fintech was very kind of new, exciting, and novel. That kind of gave birth to a second wave, which was everyone wanting to hop on the bandwagon, this sort of mania, a lot of competition, a lot of uncapitalized lenders coming into the space and just trying to claw at the addressable market. And I think what that's all resulted in is this maturation of a smaller group of fintech style lenders that are driven by technologies that we've discussed. And we see this commoditization of lenders starting to occur. And I think you've also seen certain lenders blow up either as a result of marketplace dynamics, trying to build a business model on the back of having to sell loans that was a challenge for certain lenders. But I think now you see the banks starting to say, hey, do we build, buy, or sort of partner with some of these lenders? And, if you take on Debt Capital as an example in New York, they're a great partner of ours, terrific company. They've had a partnership running with J.P. Morgan for the last year or two. And I think that's an example of a successful partnership that I think you'll begin to see more banks start to partner up with these fintech-style lenders or just go out and buy them. And so where we sit with LendingTree is, we don't really take a position on the credit quality necessarily. We're more focused on making sure that our customers have the best possible user experience and they get the best possible rate that they're searching for. And we've spent the last, 5 years through $1 billion worth of loans, which when you consider an average loan size is around $50,000, that's a lot of loans divided by $1 billion. We've gotten to know what our customers want, what's important to them, and we think providing best-in-class service compared to anybody else in the industry, and we'll certainly put ourselves up against anybody. And with the resources of LendingTree, we're really excited about the year ahead.
That I think you're providing a tremendous service. I have to tell you, in all my business, I've never heard of this operation. LendingTree, I've heard of, never heard of you before. And we thank you for bringing your insight and your information to our show today. And please stay on the line after we say goodbye to you, because we wanted to set a time that we might chat with you and see if there's something we can do to bring our audiences together. So thank you for joining us today.
That would be great. Thanks so much for having me.
We have been talking about Hunter Stuntze, SVP of Small Business Lending at LendingTree. A link to his website will be on tonight at recalculating.biz, where you can hear this and all other broadcasts of Recalculating Radio. Hunter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.